This is the son of PCJ.
Radio Berlin International.
Ici Radio Canada. This is Canada.
This is Radio Nederland, the Dutch World Broadcasting System in Hilversum, Holland.
You're tuned to Swiss Radio International in Bern.
This is Free China as a presentation of the Voice of Free China, the international service of the Broadcasting Corporation of China.
This is Radio Havana, Cuba.
Broadcasting from Cuba, free territory in the Americas.
This is Radio South Africa.
This is Yugoslavia Radio Belgrade calling.
This is Israel broadcasting from Jerusalem.
This is Radio Pyongyang of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea.
This is the General Overseas Service of the BBC.
Hello, I'm Keith Powell, and welcome to the program. Coming up today, we bring you part two with our lengthy conversation with Andy Sennett. Andy, for many years, was the editor of the World Radio TV Handbook and also hosted the Media Network blog at Radio Nederland. We also bring you the answer and who the winner is of our question last week concerning Radio RSA. So stay tuned. This is Media Network Plus, taking the computers and throwing them right out the window. I hope we paid for them first. First, here's our own Paulette McCrory with a look at some of the headlines from the world of media.
BBC Worldwide, the commercial arm of the BBC, has secured a deal with Emirates to launch CBeebies as the airline's first ever branded channel targeting children aged 6 and under. Loved by children and childminders the world over, CBeebies offers a range of high-quality programs which encourage the BBC's youngest audiences to learn through play in a consistently safe environment. Starting November 1st, 2012, Emirates will feature a bespoke, that is, custom-tailored CBeebies branded channel, showing a selection of longtime kids' favorites like the award-winning Charlie and Lola and Nina and the Neurons. Several years ago, a jammer dubbed Fire Drake became the scourge of the ham bands, broadcasting high-pitched loud music on the amateur radio bands worldwide. In response, hams sought to locate the source and silence the broadcasts. Fire Drake seems to be gone from the ham band now, although perhaps only temporarily. It still plagues the shortwave bands. A new 23-page mini-book by Stephen Handler titled Fire Drake Exposed, China's Secret Shortwave Jamming Project, exposes the source of the Fire Drake jamming. The book, which was published in May of 2012 as an e-book, reviews shortwave jamming by China, including Fire Drake and other HF jammers. It includes precise direction-finding results obtained from ITU-registered monitoring sites, identifying the transmitter sites. It also includes charts of FireDrake HF frequencies and times heard broadcasting in 2012, as well as historical charts of frequencies and times during 2011. This book provides the U.S. response as well as background information on Chinese shortwave jamming. A book by Leon Barco entitled News from the BBC, CNN, and Al Jazeera, How the Three Broadcasters Cover the Middle East, offers valuable insight into how the more powerful in society shape our views of the world through discourse and media. Barco reveals how BBC, CNN, and Al Jazeera use cultural and religious signs to identify the benign and malignant in the Palestinian-Israeli struggle and the Iraq invasion. In the book, he says, "The major problem facing Arab media is independence. If you are not independent, you cannot produce impartial discourse. The coverage of the so-called Arab Spring has demonstrated this. It is so one-sided, partial, and skewed that sometimes one is ashamed to be associated with it. It has become more sectarian than the simple and ordinary audiences on the street. It is disappointing to see major media that had established a name on the international scene towing the line of their financial sponsors. some of the major media have dropped basic standards of vetting and verification to the extent one can no longer distinguish between amateur and professional content. According to Barco, the Arab Spring seems to have destroyed even big names like Al Jazeera and Al Arabiya. Deutsche Welle has signed an agreement with the United Nations, expanding their cooperation. It's the latest development in a partnership set up 5 years ago. Deutsche Welle Director General Eric Betterman and UN Undersecretary General for Communications and Public Information Peter Lonsky-Tiefenthal signed a broadcast agreement on Monday at the UN headquarters in New York aimed at boosting cooperation in the field of media. Speaking for Deutsche Welle, Betterman stressed that the promotion of human rights, participation, and democratization is a central aspect of our multimedia programming in 30 languages, just as it is for the UN. Cooperation between Deutsche Welle and the UN is particularly important for us because of this shared sense of purpose. We'll be glad to continue working together in the future as well. Deutsche Welle's globalization magazine Global 3000, broadcasting in German, English, Spanish, and Arabic, is a prime example of this cooperation. Deutsche Welle has been able to include selected UN materials in the program, and in turn the UN's television station, UNTV, has broadcast Global 3000 since the partnership was set up in 2007. And finally, Radio Australia will broadcast coverage of the Australian Football League Grand Final on Saturday, September 29th, 2012, from 0430 to 0745 UT. It'll be part of the regular Grandstand Sports coverage. The coverage will be available on RA's shortwave and local FM relays, but it will not be available on their web stream due to content rights limitations. Shortwave coverage will be as follows. South Pacific, 11945 kHz and 15160 kHz. Southwest Pacific, 12080 kHz and 15240 kHz. Papua New Guinea and West Pacific, 9660 kHz and 15415 kHz. Southeast Asia, 17750 kHz. Reception may also be possible on 4835 kHz from the ABC Domestic Shortwave Service at Alice Springs. 4835 kHz would be a good choice for land mobile operators within 1,500 kilometers of Alice Springs. Reception of 4835 kHz may be possible beyond 1,500 kilometers. Just a note, reception of particular shortwave channels may be possible beyond the nominal target areas. Please try all frequencies to ascertain if reception is possible in your area. For these and other media news stories, please visit the Kim Andrew Elliott blog. You can find a link to the blog at the bottom of our homepage at www.pcjmedia.com. That's the media news for this week. I'm Paulette Macquarie.
And you're listening to Media Network Plus on the World Radio Network and through great partner stations everywhere. I'm Keith Powell. Coming up next, we bring you part two of our very lengthy conversation with Andy Sennett. Who is Andy Sennett? Well, let me remind you again. Andy Sennett, for many years, edited the World Radio TV Handbook, and he also presented pieces on Media Network when it was on Radio Nederland, as well as hosted the Media Network blog at Radio Netherlands. Now, part two.
Now, when you worked at BBC monitoring, let's say programs that went out live or the ones that were recorded, what would happen after the tapes? Would they just be archived or would they be erased and used for something else?
I'm not absolutely sure, but I think there was a procedure by which somebody would decide what should be kept and what can be archived. Each broadcast had a different level of importance, so it might be let the very important broadcasters would be texted in full, so the entire text would be produced. Some broadcasts would be summarized, and that required obviously some knowledge of the country concerned, and others maybe just they would simply write the headlines of news items, and then certainly the audio will be kept for a certain time. So if anybody in London requested further details of a particular item, this could be done for them.
How long did you stay with BBC Monitoring?
Just 4 years.
Your next step after that, was that with the World Radio TV Handbook?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I had envisaged on staying a lot longer than I did, but simply somebody said that there was an advertisement in Shortwave Magazine, which was mainly for radio amateurs in the UK, from Jens Frost, who was the editor of the WRTH, and he was looking for an assistant. And just a few months earlier, a colleague of mine, who was only a few years older than me, had been promoted to chief monitor in my section, so I knew that my chances of promotion, it's going to take a long time before I could be promoted to a more senior position. So I decided to have a go at the WRTH job. And I gather that because it was in a relatively obscure place, most broadcast listeners didn't see it, you know, I was the only person who applied.
I mean, up until that point, did you also consider, say, working as a broadcaster, or had you also worked as a broadcaster during that time?
No, well, as you can hear, Keith, I don't have a good radio voice. My diction is not perfect. I mean, these things can be coached. But I prefer to be working behind the scenes. My broadcasting career, such as it was, came a little later when I joined Radio Netherlands as a freelance.
How long you were with the World Radio TV Handbook?
19 years altogether. I was in... Yeah, I went to Denmark in 1978. Jens Frost retired in 1987. And then I moved to take over as editor-in-chief in Amsterdam in 1987 and had another 10 editions under my control.
Now, from that point, when you were at the World Radio TV Handbook, to when you started listening for the very first time to Radio Canada International, what were some of the major changes that took place during that time in international broadcasting? I'm not talking about, let's say, changes politically in many countries around the world, but let's say from a listening standpoint, or had shortwave from when you started listening to the World Radio TV Handbook, had it just been the same?
Yeah, I mean, I think the crucial point was the end of the Cold War. Up until then, a lot of broadcasters, you know, year by year, you've got the same programs at the same times every week with the same presenters, and often, you know, mailbag programs with letters from the same listeners. And they basically just carried on because the Cold War was on and nobody saw fit to, to get out of international broadcasting. Once, this had happened and Germany had been reunified and the Soviet states had become independent, the whole reason for a lot of these stations being on the air was started being called into question by politicians. You know, do we really need to broadcast in so many languages and so on? And so with that, the kind of programming of the languages that they decided to keep also changed, and in many cases became a lot more informal, but possibly from a politician's point of view, a lot less relevant to what they thought politicians should be approving.
You know, because we've seen, like, you know, since the Cold War ended, a lot of stations, and I would put them in the category of these small to medium-sized broadcasters, stations like YLE Radio Finland, Radio Norway, Radio Denmark, and a number of other ones, just sort of vanish into thin air. It seems that the larger and more powerful ones are around today. But international broadcasting, Andy, around that time, what was the mood in it? Because, you know, when I speak to some people like Bob Zanotti or Ian McFarland, they all tell me that at that time, people were starting to say, what do we do now?
Yeah, exactly. When I joined the WRTH, I started going around to visit various broadcasters, and I find the morale was generally quite low, and quite a lot of people had been there since, you know, for 20, 30 years, and they were sort of just looking to see how many more years they had to work until they could retire. And there wasn't a great deal of motivation to come up with new ideas and produce better programs. The only motivation was to convince the people who funded them that they should continue to be funded, and, you know, until it was time for them to retire.
Do you think, let's say, international broadcasting as it is today or as it was then would have fared better over the last, say, 20, 25 years if after the Cold War broadcasters said, okay, look, things have changed. We have to change with the times and do something different to keep an audience. Because from what I've seen, a lot of people just sat around for many years. And then when government said, oh, we're going to cut you, they went, huh? Why?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is, as I said, a lot of people have been in the business for so long. And when you're in just one business and you're not taking a wider perspective, you kind of get into a rut and you don't really realize how the world around you has changed. And I think a lot of the things that the stations were putting out, although they just kept regurgitating the same. You know, kind of format and the same content, it was becoming less and less relevant to the people who, you know, they hoped would tune in, and particularly young people. And it was mainly the audiences for international broadcasting in the last 20 years. The average age has got older and older. And, you know, if we look at some of the forums now for people who discuss international broadcasting, it's like an edition of the British sitcom Grumpy Old Men.
But, you know, it really is, Andy, you know, depending on region. I mean, if I take East Asia and Southeast Asia and the Pacific, the listeners tend to be a lot younger than, let's say, listeners in North America or in Europe.
Yeah, I think that's right, because I was mainly referring to Europe and North America, where, you know, the shortwave audience has shrunk to a very, very low amount compared with what it was 10 years ago. But certainly in parts of Asia and in Africa, you know, shortwave in many countries is still very important. And I think the problem that some broadcasters have had is that they haven't done enough research. I was, in the last few years, involved in a strategy at Radio Netherlands where we actually looked at the situation in each country. And what we found was that the situation, for example, in Africa, countries may be neighboring countries, but they had totally different media landscape. You know, for example, in Nigeria, just about everybody has a mobile phone, whereas there are still some African countries where mobile phones are by no means ubiquitous. And so you have to employ different strategies to reach people in those different environments.
But yet, Andy, you know, some international broadcasters during that transition period fared very well. I mean, for example, Radio Netherlands, after 1992, 1993, started to make major changes in the way they did programs and their presentation and everything, and remained relevant. But some other broadcasters, I can think of one right now, Deutsche Welle, didn't change at all and really didn't start to change until a few years ago.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I can't speak for other broadcasters, but certainly at Radio Netherlands, I guess we were unusual in that we had some very highly motivated people on the staff. And, you know, they were very careful about who they hired, and they would make sure that somebody was really, really genuinely interested in, you know, they weren't just going there to find a cushy job. And the result was that, you know, we would constantly discuss amongst ourselves whether we were doing the right thing, how things were going, whether we should be doing something different. And there was always plenty of new ideas coming along. And I'm not sure that was the case at all the other broadcasters. But as I say, I'm not really in a position, since I haven't worked there, to comment on that.
After you left World Radio TV Handbook, was this the time, or did you take some time off before you went to Radio Netherlands?
Well, I probably would have done. I mean, I actually, Bart Kapiras, my associate editor, and I both decided to leave at the same time. I won't go into the details why, but we had problems with the publisher. I expected to be probably unemployed for quite a few months before finding some other employment. But because I had been freelancing since 1981 with media news from the WRTH on Media Network, I knew Deanna Jansen very well, who was obviously the co-host of the program at the time. And within a few weeks, I got a call from her saying, you know, we need somebody to come and work for our new internet department. Would you like to come along and, we'll talk about it. So I got... If you like, I jokingly say headhunted, but of course, I wasn't really doing anything. They didn't have to do much hunting to find me.
So it was. It sounds like it was almost just by accident. You just happened to be at the right place at the right time, and everything was like a perfect storm. A perfect storm.
Yes, precisely. And not only that, but because I had been going to Radio Netherlands since I moved to Amsterdam in 1987, and I'd been going up to do my monthly contribution in Hilversum, so I got to meet some of the other presenters, people like Pete Myers, who was fondly remembered by everybody who worked with him, so I felt I was going to join friends. So it wasn't really like starting a new job; it was just like going back home almost.
How many years did you spend at Radio Netherlands?
Well, believe it or not, the unlucky 13, I guess. Because in it's actually 15 if you count, because I started as a freelance, then I got a part-time contract. My full-time contract started 1st of January 1999. So indeed, that's just a little over 13 years.
It's been a few months now, Andy, that you haven't worked for Radio Netherlands. You took early retirement because of a massive budget cut that affected the station. The time that you've had off, I mean, did you say to yourself, I would have liked to have stayed on for another few years?
Well, I think possibly, the way my mind had been working, I wanted to have a bit of a break because I was doing this media network weblog, and it was basically 7 days a week, 52 weeks a year. I got very little time off. I think I only had two Christmas holidays in that time. I did take time away from the office because I had to, because of the terms of the contract and so on. But, I simply sat at home and worked in my home office. So I was actually producing the same amount of material for the public as I was, when I was in the office in Hilversum. So I really needed a break. But I think I probably would have decided to go part-time had the job still been there.
And that was part two of our conversation with Andy Sennett. On a future edition of the program, we're going to bring you part three. Somebody suggested that after we air the entire conversation, that we make it available at our website, and we will be doing that. Yes, we're going to make the whole thing uncut and unedited at the Media Network Plus PCJ website very soon. Now, last week on the program, we were talking about Radio RSA, the external service of the South African Broadcasting Corporation. I had a question, and the question was, who said this?
This is Radio RSA, the voice of South Africa from Johannesburg.
Now, last week, the question that I had is, who said this is Radio RSA, blah, blah, blah? And I said the first person that sends us an email will receive a little thank you gift and a little prize. Well, of all the emails that we received, the first three were actually incorrect. Yes, the first three were incorrect. Everybody was saying, the first three people said, by the way, it was Colin Miller. No, it wasn't. It wasn't, actually. A number of you did get it right, but the first person that we received an email from on Saturday after the show went out was from Mark Williams in South Africa. And he said the answer to the RSA voice ident is Kim Shippey. You're absolutely right. That's right. Kim Shippey was the voice that we heard there just a moment ago. So, Mark, congratulations to you. And, of course, congratulations to everyone who got it right and those who didn't get it right. But Mark was the first one we received an email from. And, Mark, I will be contacting you in the next couple of days to find out and just verify your address so we can send you a little thank you gift. You're listening to Media Network Plus from PCJ Radio. Now, what can we expect for propagation? Well, our own Dan Hensley made a little boo-boo last week. I was waiting for the moment where he can make a mistake in the weather forecast or the propagation forecast, like weathermen. They say it's sunny and then it rains. Love that when that happens. We can always, poke them in the stomach and go, ha, 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 ha. Anyway, hopefully this week it won't happen again. Here's Dan Hensley.
Here's propagation for the week from September 29th to October 5th, 2012. On September 29th, the 10.7 centimeter flux starts out at 150, dropping 5 points on September 30th to become 145. On October 1st, dropping 5 more points to become 140, and yet another 5-point drop on October 2nd to bring the 10.7 centimeter flux to 135. From October 3rd to October 5th, a steady 10.7 centimeter flux at 130. The A index will be 5 from September 29th to October 2nd, spiking at a high level of 10 on October 3rd, and then remaining high on October 4th and 5th at a level of 8. The KP index will be 2 for the first 4 days of this week from September 29th to October 2nd. From October 3rd to October 5th, a KP index of 3. We see the return of sunspots this week en masse. Sunspot 1573 is rotating out of view, bringing sunspots 1575 through 1580 into view. We should see some extra D-layer absorption happening October 3rd through the 5th, with the A index being so high on those days. The solar wind blowing around Earth is thin and steady, which means it is doing little to rattle our planet's magnetic field. A far-side sunspot that exploded and hurled a bright CME into space on September 23rd is now rotating onto the Earth's side of the sun. NASA's Solar Dynamics Observatory photographed the emerging blast site during the early hours of September 26th. Because the sunspot is still near the sun's eastern horizon, foreshortening prevents a clear view of its core magnetic structure. The events of September 23rd, however, suggest that this could be a potent active region. Stay tuned for updates as a sunspot turns toward Earth. Back to you, Keith.
All right, thank you very much, Dan Hensley, for this week's propagation forecast. And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of Media Network Plus from PCJ Radio International. If you wish to contact us to let us know what you think of the program, our email address is mnp@pcjmedia.com. You can listen to this program again, as well as all past editions, by going to our website, www.pcjmedia.com/Media Network Plus, all one word. This week, by the way, if you didn't have enough of this program, I also invite you to check out the monthly 55-minute edition for the month of September. So on behalf of Dan Hensley and Paulette McCrory, this is Keith Parent wishing you well, hoping that you join us again very soon. 73s to you all, and 88s to the ladies.